Mr. James, or you go by Gimp on social media. How you doing, man?
Gimp. Yes, very well. How are you, Thomas?
Good. Very, very good. So tell me a little bit about yourself. I know who you are, but the people listening probably don't. They should, because you are you and your team are responsible for, I would argue, Devolver's most successful game.
Oh, wow. Thank you very much.
I think you would agree, right?
I don't know, actually. I guess they did Fall Guys originally, but yeah, it's done well. So my name's James Pearmain. I am the art director at Massive Monster. We recently put out Cult of the Lamb. Or actually, it's been out for a year and a half now, but it feels like it was recently. And yeah, I'm here in England, Bristol, England.
Awesome. So when you say art director, you are doing the 2D sprites for Cult of the Lamb?
Yes. Well, we have a couple of other artists now. So sort of the art team at the moment is made up of myself, and then we have Carlos Dalmau, who's kind of doing a lot of the art as well. And then Julian Wilton, who's our creative director, also does some art as well. So my role has changed a little bit over the last couple of years. But yeah, definitely kind of did a lot of the artwork in the game and the majority of all the animation as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you responsible for that look, right? That Cult of the Lamb look. It's that edgy, cute look. Are you the guy who guides, are you the guiding hand for that art?
I don't think I can take full credit for it, because I think Julian, our creative director, definitely did a lot of early pre-production work, but we kind of brainstormed a lot of ideas early on. So he kind of quickly moved to a more of a zoomed out role and kind of helping with more tech art stuff. But yeah, like definitely kind of we kind of worked together to develop that. And I think we kind of both have quite a similar art style. So kind of developed it together. But yeah, so I definitely can't take credit for that. But as the project moved on, I kind of took the art director role and kind of did the majority of the artwork and kind of started working with other artists as well later on to kind of direct them and help them kind of make stuff that would fit into the world, sort of thing.
Sweet. So let's start here. We're gonna talk about two primary things in this podcast. The first one is I want to talk about it's really about what makes effective artwork for a video game. What makes it effective from a marketing perspective? And I think Cult of the Lamb is it's a case study in the marketability, or how to make 2D art marketable. And so I want to talk about that, but I also want to talk about the technical side, which is from point A to point Z, how the game is created from the art perspective, right? Before we talk about those two things, though, I wanted to ask you how you got into this to begin with. A lot of my listeners are hobbyists right now, and they probably felt the same way you felt, like when you were, I guess you started when you were a teenager. Maybe you can tell me more about it. But I know when I started making games, I felt like it was a silly hobby, that it was never going to turn into anything. It was never going to turn into a day job. Let's start with that before we even move into the art side of things. How did you get into this? What was your journey?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started, as you said, I guess, just sort of as a hobby, making silly animations with Flash and posting them up on Newgrounds. And that was a lot of fun. And it was mainly just sort of as a way to express myself and make stupid jokes with my friends. that kind of quickly realized that I could actually make games with Flash as well. And Newgrounds was a really good sort of creative hub for that kind of thing, and you could find other people to work with. And I've never really been a programmer, or had that. My mind doesn't really work that way. But I kind of found some people to collaborate with and make some games with, just sort of for fun, really. And then I did one game that I found a programmer who was a lot more experienced than I was, and we made a game, and it did really well and made some good money. And I was kind of like, oh, I can actually, you know,
How
make money
were you?
Doing this. That was, I must have been, so the game was called Penguins with a Z, and I must have been, I think 18, 19.
Yep.
And it kind of we did, I don't know if you remember, because I know you come from a similar background of the Flash game things,
Very
but
similar. That's my first big paycheck was when I was 18, 19,
yeah
playing
yeah so
games. And
similar
I
kind
was
of
like, I made sure all my friends knew. You know, I remember I remember telling all my friends, "Holy crap, I just made 20 grand off of this stupid 15-minute Flash game on Newgrounds." So very similar situation as you.
So that exact thing, and sort of had a big chunk of money like that, and I remember taking all my friends to Amsterdam and paying for everything, getting a penthouse and blowing it all in
Yeah, I know, right? And then suddenly it's all gone.
I was saying, oh, I've spent it all, so I'm gonna have to do this again.
Yep,
But yeah,
exactly.
and I guess I think you started out in a similar time where it was quite a lucrative thing, and there was a bit of a bubble around the Flash game thing, and you could, I mean, I think the yeah, you could make a game in a couple of weeks or a month and make like tens of thousands of dollars, which was insane at the time. I
Yeah.
was,
It's a little
still at
different now.
university. It's very different now. But that was kind
The
of how I
mo
started.
right, and the really side note here for the audience, the monetizing a game is every year it's different. Like the way you make money could be different in 2025 versus 2023 and 2024. So it's always going to be different. Obviously, you're always going to have Steam sales, and that's a huge driver of I'm sure your income and how Devolver's making money. But I just want my audience to know, just because you and I made money when we were 18, doesn't mean it's completely different now. Completely different. But yeah.
Definitely, and I kind of I think I feel very privileged to have cut my teeth at a time where it was possible to do that, and we kind of, some of the games that we made didn't make loads of money, and they kind of probably failed from a financial point of view, but it was very much like spending a couple of weeks or a month on a game and getting some money from it, or maybe not so much, but kind of learning from that and then moving on to the next one. And it was a really good way of kind of figuring out what works. And but because with the Flash games are all about getting huge numbers, and also trying to hook players in as quickly as possible, because there's so many of these games on these free websites that you really have to grab people's attention. I think we kind of quickly learned what players responded well to and what they didn't. So I feel very lucky to have kind of started out there and kind of learned so much. Because now if you're trying to starting out and you're like, okay, well I'm gonna make my first Unity game and I'm gonna make it on release it on Steam and try and monetize that, you kind of to make something that's financially viable is probably gonna take you at least 6 months or a year or 2 years or however long. And there's not really so much of a place to do that now while also making money. So yeah, and so was making Flash games and had some good success of that. I worked on a lot of different Flash games and started working quite closely with Armor Games and doing a lot of art for their games. So we did Sushi Cat, which did really well, and I worked on some of the Blue Elephant games that JMTBO2 made, Elephant Quest and Achievement Unlocked, and those games.
Well, I think
And
it would be valuable really quick to just, sorry to interrupt you, Jim, or
yeah, no,
Gimp,
go for it.
or Gimp, or James, James. We're gonna call you James.
Okay, let's go for James.
Let's go
Not
with
Gimp,
James,
it's Jim.
not Gimp. Chip, whatever. James, sorry to interrupt you, James, but I wanna make sure we had clarity here. When you say you worked with Armor Games, what do you mean? Is that a publisher, or is that the old Flash website and somehow they were paying you to make a game? Can you
Yes,
add
sorry.
clarity there?
So we. The way that traditionally with Flash games you would make money would be you'd make a game and then you'd find a publisher, a sponsor to sponsor it, and they would put their branding on the game that you made, and then this game would sort of spread around these thousands of different Flash game websites, and people would click the links on a game that they like, and that would draw traffic back to the sponsor's website. So that was the kind of traditional way, but then we did some games that did well, and Armor Games got in contact with me, and they said, "Look, we're developing some games in-house. Would you like to create some artwork for them?" So that was kind of a more of a commission-based thing, where it was like, they pay me by the day, and it was more sort of developing games in-house with them, remotely. So I was kind of doing that, but then I was also making my own games that I would then get sponsorship with a lot with other programmers as well. But yeah, it was all kind of ad driven rather than people paying to play the games. It was all like based on getting huge amounts of numbers, and you get 1 cent per click kind of thing or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Gotcha.
Yeah, and so had some real good success there, and then I think it just got harder and harder to make money with Flash games, and so the iPhone came out, and I think people started playing Angry Birds on their phones and iPads rather than playing mini clip games on their desktop. And yeah, the bottom kind of fell out of it, and we kind of were struggling more and more to make a living doing it. So and that was about 9 or 10 years ago now, and decided to start a studio with Jay Armstrong, who I know you know and have spoken to very
Yes.
recently, and we started Massive Monster, I think about 9.5 years ago now, and we decided that we were going to make real games, for console. I
Yeah.
think we were kind of given a crossroads, and it was like either move to mobile, or console Steam games, and we chose
Yeah.
the
Well,
Steam console for that.
isn't mobile, couldn't you say, maybe I'm wrong here, but mobile would be more comparable to the Flash industry, right? Whereas like the game is free and you got to figure out a way to make money somehow off of a ton of clicks.
I think so, yeah. But we could kind of see where the monetization was going, and I think with Flash, it was all about just making something really fun that's going to grab people's attention. Whereas with mobile, it was more about microtransactions and how can we make this really fun game less fun so people will spend money on it. And that always kind of rubbed me the wrong way a little bit.
Yeah, me too.
Just wanted to create a thing and put it out there and not have the monetization affect it creatively or mechanically. So yeah, that was the decision we made, and I'm glad we did because I've got no beef, real beef with mobile games, and there's some great ones out there, but I do like making things that are sort of can be seen as a kind of a piece of art and something you kind of pour your heart excuse me, something you pour your heart into, and you have that product, not product, that thing that people can attach themselves to rather than the kind of microtransactions, monetization, and all that fun world. Yeah, and here we are, and we made a few games. We did Adventure Pals, which I wasn't so directly involved with, but that did pretty well. And then we did another one called Never Give Up, which didn't do so well. And then Cult of the Lambs was our third game.
Okay. Well, let's sort of bridge the gap between this final point or the point right before you guys started working on Cult of the Lamb, which is I know the feeling, which is you spend 4 years working on a game and it just sort of flops on launch. Granted, Pinstripe, my game Pinstripe, and also Never Give Up and Adventure Pals, we all shared the same publisher, which was Armor Games.
Yes.
And yes, we made money. I know for me personally, Pinstripe made Armor Games money. It ended up making money, which was awesome. But it wasn't that million-dollar game that I had dreamt of, right? And that was kind of a sad moment for me. And so, were you in a similar situation? Obviously, we don't have to talk about numbers, but in a similar situation where you're like, "Well, crap! I put my heart and soul into this thing, and it's not." People don't seem to like it like I like it.
Yeah, I think so to a degree. I mean, I think it was a slightly different situation with Never Give Up because that was more of a work for hire
I see.
thing we did with for Armor Games, who so it was based on an existing IP that they already had, Give Up, which was a very popular Flash game that did some crazy numbers, and PewDiePie did a video, and Markiplier and all these big YouTubers, and it kind of went quite viral. And I think they were like, right, we want to bring this to Steam and kind of make like a premium version. So it was kind of it was, and I think at the time as well when we took that job, it was like we'd just been struggling for money for so long, all the time, and it was kind of like it sounded like a fun project, and we thought it'd be good, but it wasn't necessarily kind of our baby, our kind of big project that we had always dreamt of doing. But it was also a really hard project throughout development, and we had lots of issues, and sort of trying to do commission work and contract work as well at the same time to just pay the bills and stuff. And then and then it came out, and I still don't think it's actually recouped, so it hasn't made any money. So it's pretty tough, and it definitely pretty crushing. I think especially coming from that Flash game thing where it's like every month you're working on something new, and if that thing flops, then okay, well, on to the next one. It doesn't matter. It's only a couple of weeks, couple of months of your life. Whereas this was like years. It's pretty crushing. I definitely had like pretty bad burnout after that.
Well, the same is true with Jay mentioned this, that Adventure Pals didn't perform like that you guys had hoped, and there's this sort of precipice that you guys landed on. Please correct me if I'm wrong, where it's like you felt like we need to figure out how to make something that actually goes gangbusters, because those two games that you worked on, they didn't necessarily prove that you guys were geniuses, right?
We knew we
And
were, we just needed to prove
right, exactly. I mean,
it.
and I'm saying that from my own personal emotional sort of paradigm, which is like I feel like I'm smart, and I just wish that, and I feel like I'm creative, and so there were times when I was making games where I would just be like, I believe in this game. I just hope that the audience can confirm what I believe. And there were moments where that just didn't happen, where it's like, no, it wasn't a great idea. So you're at this moment where you realize you need to make something gangbusters, and that is where we usher into the conversation about Cult of the Lamb. Specifically, I want to talk about Jay mentioned in the podcast that I did a couple weeks ago. He mentioned that with Cult of the Lamb, you guys had a similar approach where you're like, let's just make something silly and kind of wacky, where you're like a god riding on the back of a whale, right?
That's right, yeah.
And something like that, right? And then was it you who said, no, we need to come up with something striking and something that has a very strong hook?
I think it was Julian who was. I think it was all of us. I think, yeah, because very much we were definitely at that point where it was like make or break, and particularly after, crunching on Never Give Up and it completely flopping. And as you say, kind of knowing that we thought we could do something that was really great, and that people would resonate with people, but we were also like getting into debt, just trying to pay rent and the bills, and it was definitely a point where we're like we need to do this or not do it, and if this next one flops, then we're done, because you can't do this forever, right? You'd be better off just going to get a job somewhere. So yeah, we
So
were definitely
what?
at that point.
Awesome. Okay. So what are some things that you slowly learned after, I guess it was a decade of making games? What are some things that you learned from the art side that make a game eye-catching, that make people stop and stare at the game? What are some things that you feel game developers need to apply, and that you applied to Cult of the Lamb?
I think yeah, with the kind of the God on a floating whale idea, and we had like lots of different ideas, and we actually kind of got far enough with that idea that we were pitching it to publishers at GDC, and we kind of they weren't quite as interested as we had hoped, and we kind of went back to the drawing board, and we were like, well, why is that? And we kind of realized that the idea was quite convoluted, and there was a lot of different ideas going on, and we really needed to find that kind of that gem and that kind of concept, an idea and tagline that people would resonate with, and from like and that kind of goes through from the idea of what the actual game is all the way through to the art style as well, and they kind of all have to be connected. So I think for us it was from like a an art point of view, it was once we had that idea, like how do we attach a style and imagery that kind of helps elevate that, and everything kind of needs to all be working together towards the same goal. So like the idea of start your own cult. Once we had that idea and that theme, there was so much like visual identity that we could take from that. All the religious imagery, and like making sure that goes through every single thing in the game, from the character designs to the colors you're using to the imagery throughout the world. It all kind of works together to support that idea of starting your own cult.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and that was yeah. I think that was really a light bulb moment, and we were kind of. I don't know if you've ever been in this position where you're kind of. You've got all these little nuggets of ideas, and you're trying to piece them together, and you kind of got these characters in mind, but they don't quite work for you, and you know what the game is, but it's like, oh, I don't know. And then for us anyway, you kind of we had the idea of starting your own cult, and then everything else kind of came real naturally after that, from
I
the
know the feeling.
characters. Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I get it because we're in that same exact situation with our game Twisted Tower, and we stylistically we were kind of all over the place. We knew we liked BioShock, right? But that wasn't enough. And so for 2 years, well, it was probably about a year and a half, it felt like we were sort of floundering and just trying to keep our head above water and not get drowned in too many ideas, too many visual flavors and visual styles. And it wasn't until we realized that it's a first-person shooter fairy tale, that's when
Nice.
we go, got it. That's
There
the
you go.
style.
Yeah.
And it all clicked. And that was actually very helpful with a conversation I had with Jay. It was about a year ago where I was like, that's what we're going for. And so essentially all we had to do was we said, okay, let's take Cinderella, let's take Alice in Wonderland, and let's put that into a first-person shooter. What does that look like, right? It was, and so you are so spot on when you say that the hook dictated the visual style. And my question about that is, can the visual style dictate the hook, or is it easier to start with the hook first and then spread that to the visual style?
I mean, I don't think there's a right or wrong way of doing it. I mean, I think if you look at something like Cuphead, that the art style is so first and foremost, like that is like, I don't even really know what it's a side scrolling shooter, right? It's a really hard side scrolling shooter, but it the art style almost defines that entire game.
But I guess
So
you
I
could, even with that game, you could probably use the same mentality, which the hook is, it's if a video game was in the 1930s.
Right.
And so that's the hook, and then the visual style spreads after the hook. Potentially, maybe, I don't know.
But I think you probably could approach it for both from both directions. For us, it was very much like we know we want to make Stardew Valley meets Binding of Isaac, but we need an idea to unify those. And as soon as it was like, okay, you're this cult leader who's going out killing monsters, recruiting cute animals to this cult. And we have the cult theme. Everything else kind of came from that. And we also had like all, as you say, have all these different pieces, and you don't know how they all fit together. And then once you have that idea, that defines the art style and it defines the game. But there's also all these other pieces that don't fit into that vision that you just have to get rid of because they're kind of muddying that vision and making it like the floating whale thing, it just didn't make sense. Like we had this idea for this floating whale, but it didn't really. It was like a cool idea that we liked, but it just didn't fit into that idea at all, really. And we could have probably trying to hammer it in, but sometimes it's better just to sort of let go of these things that you become attached to because you put time into it. But you need to. That's definitely a big lesson we learned on this one. The other thing I was going to say as well was as well as the finding the hook and what the theme of your game is, I think also just playing to your strengths and finding what your voice is as well, because I think if you're trying to sort of do something that doesn't come naturally and doesn't isn't you as an artist, then it's going to be
Sorry.
really hard the whole way through to make it work. So I think our games have always been kind of cute, cartoony, 2D, kind of hand-drawn style. So we kind of, it was really important to us to kind of keep that as a huge part of the game. But then we knew we wanted to add these darker elements as well, and the religious imagery, and that kind of helped
Well,
it
that
all come together.
contrast is a
But
huge.
I think if we had tried to make
Right.
it like really gritty and some kind of style that wasn't us and didn't come naturally, then it would have been a lot harder to stand out and for it to feel true to us.
Gotcha. Sorry, we're getting some lag here. Hang on one sec. Can you
Oh,
say
sorry.
something? No, it's not your fault. You there?
Hello. Yes, I'm here. I can
Hello.
hear
Okay,
you.
good. Okay, good. Yeah, no big deal. We don't need to, start over or cut anything. We'll just keep rolling.
Okay.
That contrast is, was it luck? The reason I say that is because your strength, yours and Julian's strength is cute, hyper cute characters. And that was like, I think all the way back to the Happy Tree Friends. Do you remember Happy Tree Friends?
Yeah, of course. Of
And I'm
course.
sure that was an inspiration for you guys because the reason why Happy Tree Friends, and for those of you listening who don't know, it's just basically a bunch of forest creatures, super cute, kind of like Warner Brothers vibes, or even like a kid, like a Nick Jr. show, but all of them are getting like slaughtered, right? That was from like early 2000s. I remember watching those videos and feeling really cool when I was in middle school. But the reason why
Yeah.
those did so well is because there was contrast, right? You have super cute and then super dark, and you slam them together and you get something that's viral. When it comes to Cult of the Lamb, was that an intentional thought process of we're going to create contrast? How do we create contrast? Okay, let's put cults next to cute creatures. Or were you kind of lucky where it just worked out and that contrast became viral?
It was definitely a conscious decision to. I mean, I think it came in two parts. The first part was we had a lot of our previous games, and like Adventure Palace, for example, which is like really quite cute and kind of silly. And I think we saw a lot of comments of people thinking it was like a kid's game,
Yep.
and kind of. And I think as soon as you have that cartoon style, particularly our specific style, which is quite like Saturday morning cartoon, I think it instantly puts quite a lot of people off. And then we were sort of seeing games like Don't Starve and Binding of Isaac, which had a real element of darkness to them and had huge success. So I think it was definitely a conscious decision to that we wanted to keep the kind of cute cartoony stuff, but we also really wanted to add the darkness and make it a bit messed up. I think coming from Flash games, the for me at least, I think the super cute cartoon stuff went really well and was really popular, and that, I kind of fell into a little bit of a trap doing that. Like starting out, like you said, I loved Happy Tree Friends, and I even made like my own sort of knockoff Happy Tree Friends cartoons and that kind of thing. But I kind of lost that kind of that darkness a little bit. I think just because I saw such success with the cutesy stuff. But then going to sort of Steam games, I think the audience is quite different there. And they really appreciate that. So it was definitely like quite early on, something that we wanted to do, and before we had the cult idea. And then I think when we had that the idea, start your own cult, it all fell into place because we're like, right, well, you're this kind of, satanic cult leader, but then the animals are really cute, and that kind of juxtaposition felt really natural, and it came very naturally, and it was a theme that we wanted to explore as well, was the sort of the good and evil, the light and dark, the cute and the horrific, and as a cult leader, like you're sort of you're given this power, do you do good or do you do bad? So that kind of it was it. It was almost a happy accident, in that the kind of theme eventually came together so well with the art direction. So yeah, it was a kind of mix of both, I guess.
Well, I see the game and when I look at everything, that from the gameplay to the story to the hook to the themes and even to the visuals, everything it leans on one primary principle, and this is just my theory. It's all about contrast. It's like there's contrast in everything. And can we talk about that when it comes to color and lighting, and even like marketing material? Like when I look at Cult of the Lamb, your color palette is so bizarre, but I can almost taste it. It's so flavorful. Can you
How does it
talk to me?
taste?
It tastes kind of like a really sugary cupcake with like jalapenos in it. Like
Oh, nice.
it's
Sounds
like got some, I
awful.
know, right? It's but you wouldn't think it works, but there's actually desserts that do that, where it's like you've got contrast of two seemingly different flavors that wouldn't work together, but they work. You've got vibrant, almost it's almost like a neon red mixed with like a parchment yellow. And so I'm curious if you could speak to just some tips and tricks and your thought process behind color theory when it comes to Cult of the Lamb.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think very early on the project, originally we wanted to make the whole game in this very limited color palette. And I think we were like, you got to pick five colors, and everything in the game has got to use just those colors, and there's no other colors allowed. And I think some games do that really well and keep things really striking. For us, that idea kind of fell away a little bit because I think we wanted all these different color animals, and we wanted the biomes to feel quite different color-wise. But that idea still kind of persisted through a lot of the marketing images and the characters. So I think, yeah, picking a palette that kind of defines your game early on can be really powerful. Even if you don't like exclusively use it for the artwork, I think it can really help form the identity of the game. So I think with Cult and the Lamb, you got the black and the red, which are kind of quite evil and dark, but then it's really had the kind of light white cream color to kind of represent the lightness. And also there's like a kind of bright neon-y greeny blue that we use as well, which is quite a light sort of holy color, which we don't use as often. But yeah, and I think that really helped, particularly with like the UI and the kind of the marketing stuff, to just keep things consistent and kind of keep like a visual identity for the game that kind of goes through everything. So yeah, I think that's super valuable to do.
So
We
how
kind
did
of
you go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, so it's kind of quite early on in the project. We kind of in the pre We went through a lot of pre-production, and we kind of came up with this color scheme and the fonts and some symbols and basically a set of rules and visual motifs that we wanted to use, and kind of created a bit of a Bible. And that was really useful just as we kind of went through the full production of the game, to have that to refer back to, and make sure everything kind of uses some of these ideas. And I think especially when you're kind of bringing on other artists as well, like later in the process, it's really useful to have those rules you set out for the world and the imagery and the identity of the game, to have that to refer back to, and make sure that you're kind of, yeah, just it's that's permeating through every aspect of it.
Color is it's almost like a sixth sense. Obviously we can all see, but what I mean is like to be able to know which colors work together just right away. Like you can immediately go red, black, cream. Like you just know. A lot of people listening, I would argue the majority of listeners, they don't have that sense. And that's not, it's not anybody's fault. It's just certain people are just gifted in that way. Could you recommend any way for my audience to know what to lean on if they don't necessarily have that gifting? Like, are there any tools or websites that they can lean on to choose a color palette?
Yeah, and there's loads of websites out there. Even like you go on Illustrator, and there's kind of you can choose different color palettes, and it will show you what the complementary colors are. So if you pick, like, let's say a red that you really like, and you're like, okay, I want to base this, I want to use this color as like the kind of core, it will then, it will show you, and they have different names of like the different color theory palettes, and it will show you all the different complementary colors and the secondary colors, and that can be really useful, even if you, like, you don't know. I don't really know too much color theory, and I kind of base a lot of stuff on just trial and error, to be, if I'm perfectly honest. And that, but you kind of find that the stuff that you end up stumbling on through trial and error is actually following the rules of color theory. So just like, picking a color that you think looks really nice, using a tool to find the complementary colors, is a really good way of kind of getting you there. And I'm sure there's loads of YouTube tutorials about and or videos about like the meaning behind different colors. Like, red is a kind of warning, danger color, whereas blue is kind of serene and relaxing, and all these different kind of themes and emotions that you can attach to different colors should be relatively easy to find. And I think a lot of it is kind of almost obvious when you read it, but I think
Well,
it's.
there's something I've identified. I've studied y'all's artwork obsessively because I love 2D art, and I'm so impressed with what you've done. And something I've noticed is there's three types of contrast you use. You use contrast in hue, contrast in lightness, and contrast in saturation. The point being, with hue, it's complementary colors. So you have red, and then you have the blue, right? Those are your complementary colors, generally speaking. And it might be a full, like 180 degree contrast, but it might actually be even triadic. I'm not sure. But you also have contrast and saturation, which is you've got that low saturation, almost like a paper color, the cream, right? And then you've got a super high saturation, like 100% high saturation of that red, right? And then you've also got contrast and lightness, where you've got dark shadows and silhouettes, and then you've got vibrant bright, probably near the center of where you manage your cult. So you've got this sort of contrast in every way when it comes to color. You guys have really mastered that, because when I look at your previous games, you didn't necessarily do that. I want to lead that into a question, sort of a final question about color, which is how. Did you guys ever stretch your legs outside of those rules? Was there ever a moment where you go, you know what, we need to do a little bit of pink here, or we need to do a little bit of yellow here?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's kind of why, yeah, originally, as I say, we were trying to use this very limited palette, but it kind of felt a little bit too limiting in the in to use for everything, because we wanted the game to feel really vibrant as well, and I think all our games have always have been, and we want it to feel, yeah, super colorful and like a Saturday morning cartoon. So I think there's definitely areas that you can stray from it, but sometimes it does just look out of place. So I think it's, for me, it's just been a bit of trial and error, and making certain things pop that you want to kind of draw attention to. I think with all the kind of core things and the main visual language in the game, we do try and stick to it, to those kind of core colors that we use for the identity. But yeah, I do find myself just putting in other stuff here and there just to kind of make it feel unique in the world, kind of thing. Like for example, we got all these buildings in the cult, right? And a lot of it is kind of, it's all like sort of natural materials, and a lot of it is wood and stone and, wood painted red, and using that kind of that palette that we've used for a lot of stuff, and green as well for like the grass, because we wanted it to feel verdant and luscious. But I have found with like the more recent buildings, I kind of want to mix it up a little bit. So we've added like a tailor building, and I just didn't feel right in all these different colors, and I tried all the different colors, and then I kind of just tried it like a pink and purple, and it just worked, and it gave the, it's quite a flamboyant kind of color scheme, which kind of fits with the idea of tailoring clothes and dressing up your followers, and it just made it kind of gave that building its own identity, and there wasn't really much of a mindset or reasoning behind it, other than that I was just trying all these different colors and that worked. It looked good, and it just felt right. So I think a lot of it is just kind of what feels right and what experimenting, I think. And don't be too afraid to break your own rules as well, because that's sometimes where the magic comes from. If it's not working and you're following all these rules that you set, and then sometimes when when you break your own rules, that's when the kind of real magic happens.
Okay. So to sort of wrap up the color conversation, would you agree that it's a generally it's a good idea to have a set color palette that is your brand? It's kind of what you put in your Bible, your the Bible. For those who listening who don't know, a Bible would be what are the fonts, what are the colors, what's the themes, what are the symbols and identities. So yes, it's good to have a set standard for color and to build your game on that foundation. And then once you fully understand that language, that color language, then you can start sprinkling in new colors. But it's best to start with a foundation first. Would you agree that that's a good general rule?
Absolutely, and that really
Okay.
helps kind of just give it that identity and feel consistent.
Okay.
Yeah, totes.
Cool. Okay, well, now that we understand how you created this, or sort of the thought process or the philosophy behind the art direction, let's talk about the technical side.
Okay.
Before we get into the point A to point Z of how you actually did it all, let's talk about tools really quick. So let's just really quick list off the tools you use for the artwork.
Super simple really. We just draw everything in Photoshop, import it into Unity, job done. For the animation, I use Spine, which is really good. A great little 2D animation tool. But yeah, beyond that, there's not really much else. It's all
What about an Illustrator?
haven't used Illustrator for anything, mate.
Me neither. I don't like using it. It's so clunky for me. It's heavy. It feels
It's
kind of
kind
like
of.
overkill.
I mean, I always come from that Flash game background, which is vector based. So this was actually the first game we ever did that used Photoshop, so, and it was quite the learning experience going from doing everything in Flash to Photoshop. But I think we wanted. There's another thing that we kind of noticed looking at a lot of other games was like having that kind of more textured feel. That you can only really get from bitmap is gives a kind of sense of, I don't know what it is, it's a sort of sense of depth and grit and almost authenticity, and it might just be like a what's currently popular thing, but that was kind of definitely a conscious decision as well, was to try and keep the cartoony cartoon bright colorful style, but also add that layer in the darkness and the grit and slightly rough edges to the lines and stuff. So yeah, it was definitely a big learning process moving from that. But then we were like, yeah, there's no vector, it's all Photoshop.
Okay. Well, what about sourcing texture work? Sourcing brushes. Yes, we've got Photoshop and we've got Unity, and they work. Those two are probably open 95% of the time. But do you ever find yourself in a browser going and grabbing some textures or assets?
We definitely we found some brushes that we liked and that were kind of just available for free, and then we kind of tweaked them a little bit. We've got like the line brush, and then we've got the shading brush, and then there's like a watercolor brush which we use to kind of create a lot of the shadows and textures and kind of grit, I guess. And so we don't really use too much actual like textures, the sprites or anything in the game. It's all kind of usually just drawn by hand. But yeah, definitely finding the right brushes, because was a big part of just trying to get the style we wanted down, and having those, and again like putting those in the Bible and deciding what the line widths are going to use for the characters are, and what the line widths we're going to use for the environments are, and what brush we're going to use for the shadows, and making sure that we follow that throughout the whole game, and so everything's consistent there. But yeah, it's pretty basic really. We've got 4 four brushes in Photoshop, and then just draw it straight in Photoshop, import it into Unity. And yeah, there's not much too much else from like a technical point of view until it's actually in the game, and then.
Well, what about hardware? Are we using a mouse? Are we using a Wacom pen tablet?
Yeah, I got a Wacom, which is great. And just I started out on a MacBook, and the Photoshop files just got bigger and bigger, and the MacBook kind of struggled more and more. And Julian persuaded me to get a decent PC, and it was amazing to be honest. Like, it's amazing having the scratch disks not running out, and just
I
you
know.
know. I think once
Well,
you're working with big files, it really slows you down eventually.
you could buy a Mac that runs great, but it would be 5 grand.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true.
I had to convert to PC as well, obviously, but I ended up actually, one sec, I'm going to show the camera. I ended up buying a Mac Studio because it's the only well, it's the only thing that'll run Logic Pro. So I
Yeah.
write my music as well. So I have my setup here currently is I have a little switcher. It's stuck to the side of my PC, and it switches between my two monitors. It'll switch both monitors between Mac and PC.
Oh, very
So it's
fancy.
sort of yeah. It's I'm trying my best to automate everything because. And that's why I have my keyboard on my desk right now, my MIDI controller, because as quick as possible, I could switch between different crafts. The less frustrated I am when I'm making games. So that's what I'm kind of setting up my studio to do right now. But for
That's
you
pretty
know,
cool.
you yeah, I appreciate it. For you're just spending all your time in Photoshop, right? Photoshop, you have a pen tablet, and then are you importing the PSDs, PSBs, or PNGs to Unity?
Usually it's PNGs, yeah.
Really? So you're exporting everything, and you're not saving the PSDs.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the right way to do it, to be honest. With Spine, we do export the PSDs because you can kind of set the layers up in for a character, and you have like the arms and different body parts, and then you can export the PSD and then import that into Spine, which is saves some time. But yeah, usually I don't know, man. We don't know what we're doing. We're just.
Well, clearly you did. Yeah, I ask because I abandoned exporting PNGs and I also abandoned Spine for
Oh yeah.
Unity's proprietary PSD importer. They also have a PSB importer, which allows you to weight paint your actual character inside of Unity with Unity's new 2D animation tool. So I was curious because I left Spine, but I know that it's still having updates, and I was curious about that. So let's move this discussion into the technical side. I would love to
Okay.
hear, and we could talk about Spine and all that. I'm going to frame this question so that you can hopefully give us like the most effective answer, because I could say, how did you do it? Like how are you creating art? But what I'm going to frame the question is a little bit more precise, which is if you were to tell your let's say your 18-year-old self, here's how you're going to do artwork from start to finish for this multi-million-dollar explosive viral game. What is that process like from start to finish? That means from ideation to pen and paper to Photoshop to Unity. What's the process look like?
From a creative point of view, or
Yeah, the creative side, but primarily the technical side. The creative side would be like more like the ideas and but mainly I'm looking for like the technical side. Like if you were to teach this and people wanted to learn how you did what you did with the artwork, what's it look like?
that's tricky. I think just practice lots, right? And learn how to use the tools as well. And I'm very stuck in my ways about not learning new techniques and stuff. So I think it's just like I really am, and it's bad. But I think it's really important to be to not be afraid of learning new techniques. And because
Mm-hmm.
even like going from Flash to Photoshop, I was really stubborn about it and I didn't like it, and it took me a long while to get used to it. But yeah, I think ultimately it was for the best. So I think it's just really important.
Yeah.
And this is a, you know, this is advice for myself right now as well, is don't be afraid of, you know, learning and pushing yourself to try new things and techniques, because in the long run you're probably going to save yourself a lot of time. But yeah, I don't know. I think just stick at it
Well,
and keep practicing and learning and.
does it start? Let's figure out like the line. Okay, so starting from point A to point B. It's a difficult question, I understand. I totally get it. That's why I'm trying to learn how to frame this when I ask developers who come on the podcast, because it's a difficult question, which is what, 'cause a lot of times we're just on autopilot and it's like, what? You just draw a character and learn how to draw a character. So maybe I'll ask it a different way. Does it start on a piece of paper? Does, for example, a character, does it start as a sketch?
Usually I'm not the, I don't do too much drawing on paper. I find it kind of quicker, and I'm just so used to drawing on a computer. And
Yeah.
but yeah, I think it's kind of with, yeah, how do you start out with drawing a character, designing it? I think it's figuring out what the character's personality is and what are the goals that you want the character to be. So for Cult of the Lamb, we wanted the lamb to feel really iconic and simple, but also, you know, complicated enough that it felt interesting. And that kind of involved lots of tweaking and copy and pasting the same design, but changing the size of the eyes slightly, or changing the style of the ears, or and just kind of really going through iteration and kind of doing it in a. I mean, I'd love to say you just kind of sit and sketch it a few times and then you're like, okay, that's the perfect character, but it's really been a kind of a case of iterating and just tiny changes until you kind of figure out the what works best through just changing things and kind of, yeah, going through many, many different versions. And maybe that's not the kind of
Right.
the most cr kind
No,
of
yeah.
creative auteur way. Like, you love to think that true artists just create things out of thin air, but that for us, that's definitely been the process, you know,
Yeah.
drawing lots of things, picking bits that you kind of like from one and others and kind of putting them together and then redrawing it, and eventually you kind of get to something, you're like, okay, this is the one.
Yep. And so
That's
that's all done in Photoshop. You just open up Photoshop. Is it a 4K document for, let's say, a character, for example? So would you just start with a 4K document, or would you start really rough with a
super
low
duper
resolution
rough, yeah,
sketch?
just like super
Yeah.
lines and kind of, because I think you kind of want the, you know, it's important that the silhouette's strong, and the main features are like the defining features are kind of figured out first, and then once you have, and you can do that just with very simple thick basic lines. It doesn't have to like look too good. It's just like figuring out what the, yeah, the silhouette and the defining features of that character are, and then once you have that, you can go in and do more details and kind of tweak the different features and try out different ideas for them, until you're kind of iterating it. And then once you're like, okay, this is the design, and it's still kind of rough, but I've kind of copy and pasted the horns from this one onto this one, and then I'm like, okay, this looks good, and then you kind of actually draw it for real kind of thing. Once you're, the design is decided, it's you actually do the final one, and that's when you try and like really caring about making every line perfect. And until that point,
Exactly.
you don't need to worry too much about that. It's
So it's
just
kind of like
get
a
to the design.
logo. It's kind of like logo design.
Yeah, totally.
Okay. Tell me
Definitely for
more about
the.
this. Tell me more about the silhouette. What do you mean by silhouette is strong? What does that mean?
So I think there's this principle that you that a good character has like a really, you can tell which what the character is just by looking at his silhouette. So if you kind of take Homer Simpson or Marge Simpson and just fill it in full black, and all you can see is the shadow of it, the silhouette. You can still recognize what the character is, and it has a very clean, well-defined silhouette. And that just really helps with just making a character recognizable and iconic. Because sometimes you have, you know, I'm drawing a character and I'm like, okay, I want it to have huge horns and I want it to have these kind of, I don't know, big eyebrows and ears or whatever. But if they're kind of overlapping and it kind of makes a bit of a mess, it doesn't just doesn't work, and it looks a bit messy. And you're like, okay, well, I wanted it to have these big horns, but if I shrink the horns a little bit and it kind of stops it overlapping from the ears or whatever, then that kind of it, the overall design is a lot stronger and more easy for the viewer to kind of just decipher at a glance. And just, I don't know, it's a kind of it's a funny thing that you just kind of intrinsically notice, I think, or subconsciously notice.
Yeah, I've been learning that actually. It's so funny. I've been doing this for 10 years. Or honestly, it's been about 15 years of making games. We're making 3D games now, but I was making 2D games, right alongside you. We were just in different places in the world, and we didn't know each other, but we were making 2D games at the same sort of age and time. And I never knew about the silhouette principle. I guess instinctively kind of understood it.
I think it's one,
And
yeah, there are so many different theory things that you don't necessarily know the theory behind, but you kind of you read about the theory and you're like, okay, well, I do that already, and it took me 6 years to figure it out. I wish I'd read a book.
I know. Well, okay, so do you illustrate your characters, or do you conceptualize your characters in the context of the game? So what I mean is, do you screenshot something from the game? Do you understand what your world looks like before you make your character? Because I know when it comes to the silhouette, you can't even see the silhouette if the character's blending into the color palette of the background. So what's your process look like there?
Yeah, I think you definitely want to know the context of what it's going to be in. Particularly, I mean, I guess for Cult of the Lamb, if I'm designing an edit, because we kind of wanted the designs of the characters to be quite like the enemies and stuff. We wanted each biome to have its own kind of type of animal and color palette, and that we want the certain enemies, if it's an enemy that kind of shoots a exploding bomb, and there's a frog that does that, or there's a jellyfish that does a similar thing. We want all those kind of types of enemies to be a specific color, but then we also want them to fit in their respective biomes. And then there's also like these kind of orange globules that we have on certain enemies, and if an enemy has that, then it explodes. Well, you know it's going to explode when you kill it, kind of thing. And all these kind of different rules that you kind of used so the player kind of understands. I mean, maybe that's something that's a little bit more specific to enemy designs, or the more the gameplay stuff. So you kind of develop this visual language, and it's kind of tricky because sometimes it can be hard to be creative because you're like, okay, well, it's got to be a frog because it's in this area, and it's got to be this color because it's this type of enemy, and it's got to have this because it's going to do this when it dies. And but you got to kind of design the character within those limitations, I guess.
Okay, so you've got your character, you use context, so you're creating your character maybe with a backdrop or a background in Photoshop to understand where it is when it comes to the color so it stands out. Now, are your characters are they designed with layers, or do you merge all the layers together and it's just a drawing and then you create sprite animations from it? Or do you
It's
rig
all
up the character with various layers? What's your process like for animation and setting it up for rigging?
yeah, it's all in different layers. So, and I really like with Cult of the Lamb, we wanted a vibe, right? And we wanted a very bouncy kind of, everything's moving all the time. So I think I like having different bits that I know are going to move or are going to kind of wave and stuff. So you kind of you, everything's on a separate layer, and then if an arm, it's going to bend, you have to kind of draw it straight because you're going to rig that up to a mesh. So certain things you'll have to draw, like, or a jellyfish, for example, all the jellyfish tendrils will have to be, you draw them straight, so then you can kind of turn them into a mesh and bind the mesh to a bone and make them animated. So yeah, draw everything straight and in a way that is not deformed, and it can be deformed from. Export them into Spine, and then you kind of set them up in the layout that they're going to have, attach bones to them. If it's going to be a mesh, which means yeah, you just kind of you want to deform them like you would a jellyfish limb, or I mean pretty much everything in Cult of the Lamb is meshes because we really wanted everything to have a sort of squash and a stretch and a sway and a we wanted it to feel bouncy. And yeah, and then just attach the bones to it and you're good to go.
Gotcha. So let's talk about iteration really quick. How often, I'm going to assume, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm going to assume that you weren't just one and done. It's like, yay, we made the protagonist and we're good to go. Did you have to go back to the drawing board and do it all over again multiple times?
Oh my God, so many times with everything. Like particularly early on in the game when we're, you know, even when we decided the cult theme and stuff, we really were absolutely brutal with everything, particularly like the important stuff, but even the stuff that isn't even that important, just really, particularly like me, Jay and Julian, just being brutal with each other about what we thought about it and whether it worked or if it sucked or if we think it could be better. And then you finally get to a place where you're like, okay, this is good, and you get it in and it's good, and then you're like, okay, I'm happy with this. This is great. How can we elevate it and make it even better? And that was sort of something we've really tried to do throughout the whole process with everything in the game was really when you're happy with it and you think it's good enough, how can you make it better? Really pushing yourself to do that. It was a brutal process though.
Well, you mentioned it's brutal. What I'm curious about is, did it ever make you think like we're incompetent and
Yes.
we are a wasteful team? I
Always.
ask that from personal experience because I feel that way all the time, especially when I'm delegating to a team, because I'm like, I'm sorry, you're gonna have to redo this, but you need to redo it. And then I already apologized for it, and then 2 weeks later I say, sorry, bud, you're gonna have to redo it again. And so I feel incompetent, you know?
Yeah, totally. I always feel that you know, imposter syndrome, and I think everyone does. But to be honest, I think it's something that keeps you humble. I think as soon as you think everything you do is hot shit, then you're gonna stop trying. So I think it's important to keep that. But yeah, it can be very frustrating, and it can be. I think particularly at the beginning of the project, where I was at a place where we just don't never give up, and it flopped, didn't make any money. I was very frustrated. I was moving from Flash to Photoshop. It's about, and just felt like nothing was good enough. But I think you just have to kind of stick with it and really find your motivation and dig deep yeah, just keep banging your head about it. Sometimes move on to something different, and then come back to it with fresh eyes. I have a very bad habit of kind of sitting and being like, okay, I'm gonna get this character or animation or whatever it's done this evening, and then it's sort of 2 a.m. and it's still not good enough. No, I'm not going to bed until it's done, but I think sometimes walking away and coming back to it with fresh eyes can be really valuable.
I
Or
feel the
just
same way.
throwing it away, starting from scratch.
Man, it's such a terrible feeling. It's almost like a drug where you're glued to your computer. And you, it, for me, so I've got 3 kids. Well, I've got a third one on the way. And
Nice.
I get off at I'm supposed to get off at 5:30. And when it's 5:29, I'm like so obsessed with trying to figure something out, you know? And you've got to just, you almost got to rip the band-aid off and like slam your computer, your laptop closed, or turn your computer off and just get out and stop yourself. Because something about making games is super addicting. I don't, do
Oh
you feel
yeah.
that way? Do you feel kind of like a workaholic?
Oh yeah, I'm a complete obsessive, you know, really dialing down and obsessing over every tiny little detail, like sometimes to the pixel, you know. It's ridiculous, but it just doesn't quite look right, and you're tweaking it, tweaking it, tweaking it, tweaking it, and eventually you get there. But yeah, I think it's a dangerous thing, but I also th I kind of I don't think I think it'd be very hard to do it without having a little bit of that in you.
Well, John Carpenter, I don't know if you like any of his films. but
I
you know,
don't
he
know if
did
I've watched too much of it, but yeah, I'm well
like
aware of.
Halloween and The Thing, and he mentioned that he never likes his movies. He's never happy with his films. When I see Cult of the Lamb, I think this is a perfect game.
Oh
There are
yeah.
n there's
Wow.
literally I do, I really do. I see a perfect game, and I'm sure most people do. My question for you is, sort of to wrap this up here, this is sort of a final question. Do you see a perfect game?
No, definitely not. Definitely not. I think you. I don't know if there's even a such thing as a perfect game. And I think you're always thinking about things that you can improve. You're always seeing the flaws in it. But it's just about getting it to as a place where you're as close as possible to being happy. I mean, I was playing. I started playing Hollow Knight again over the weekend, and I was playing that game, and then I kind of jumped over to Cult of the Lamb just because the new updates just came out, and I wanted to test it a little bit on PlayStation because I hadn't played the new update on PlayStation. And I was like, going
Yeah.
from Hollow Knight to Cult of the Lamb, I was like, oh, God damn it, the colors are all wrong. This looks like crap compared to Hollow Knight. And yeah, you're always thinking of, oh, I could have done this better, and it's too late now. But
Yep.
yeah, so
I struggle to even see that discrepancy. Like when I see Cult of the Lamb and I see Hollow Knight, to me they're both equally valid in their visuals.
I
They're
take that as a
both
huge compliment, thank
phenomenal.
you. I'm not sure I
I
agree,
mean,
but
Hollow Knight is a huge inspiration to me as well, and it obviously. And there's something to be said about the painful growth, or the painful process of learning to hate what you just loved. So like. Like you mentioned, staying up till 2 a.m. and you're making these characters perfect. Well, they're perfect until 2 a.m. and then a week later you look back and you go, well, actually I should have done this and I should have done that. You know? And so in a you've grown, right? And so that is like I can't I what I'm trying to say here is 99.9% of the people listening to this podcast don't have that visual muscle that you now have, where you can critique Cult of the Lamb, but I couldn't, and my audience couldn't. We couldn't see what you see. And that is a huge gift, but it also hurts at the same time. You know
That's why we're just still updating the game. Just gonna be, we'll do another
what
one in 10 years' time, and I'll still be like, yeah, it's not perfect yet. It's
mean? Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
yeah.
Well, speaking of updates, to wrap up here, we in the description of this video is the obviously link to Cult of the Lamb, but you guys recently did an update. Do you want to talk about it?
Yeah, we did. We did an update called Sins of the Flesh, which adds. It's kind of meant to be the cult depth update. So the previous one we did was like more depth to the dungeon, and this one's more depth to the cult. Ideally, we would have done both at the same time, but we just ended up adding so much stuff. But yeah, it adds lots of new fun stuff like follower mating, so you can have a little have two followers go in the little tent, and you get an egg, and then you can hatch the egg into a baby follower. And you can do a nudism ritual, so your followers will throw their robes off and dance around with a little leaf covering their private parts.
That's so funny.
There's a drink house, so you can grow hops and grapes and brew drinks for your followers to get befuddled, or get them all drunk.
I love that.
Loads
That's
of
such a
stuff.
good idea. That's so good.
And
Man. Well,
it's
so
all
you
kind of
guys
creating the
have like,
sin.
that's right, exactly.
Yeah.
So you're kind of in a situation where feature creep is happening after launch,
Yeah.
which is great because it keeps people engaged, and you guys have a, I think you have an evergreen game, and you should be really, really proud. And so yeah, dude, I'm so grateful for your time here. I feel really, really lucky to be able to talk to you because not everybody can, and I appreciate your time, dude.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Thomas. It's been
Yeah.
lovely. Big fan of your work as well. So it's yeah, it's been
Thanks.
great to catch up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very
Cool.
much.
Yeah, man. All right, take it easy.
Bye.
Get over here. Get down. Hey, thanks for watching. By the way, if you haven't downloaded that free 2D game kit below, click below. It's my treat to you. I used this game kit to make a game for PewDiePie in 14 days, and I actually got to play it with him in front of his audience, which was really cool. This game kit is totally free. It's my treat to you, and you can use it however you want. You can make a commercial game and make $1 million off this game kit. I don't care. Or you could just use it for a hobby project. It's my treat to you. And by the way, if you haven't clicked like, that would mean a ton to me. Hit subscribe. And also, this is important, hit that notification bell. Here's why. If you get notified of when I'm live, you can watch me make my next game and let me know in the chat what you think about the game or any ideas you have. And you might just show up, your chat might just show up in the next video that I upload. All right. I'll talk to you later. Bye. I love you too.